My topic today is the myth of the autonomous individual, and I'm going to try to take it down. And for those of you, some of it gets a little philosophically thick, and so for those of you who might not be accustomed to that kind of argument, I'm going to give you a picture that you can hold in your minds through that, and I want you to think about the Columbine High School massacre. And if you hold on to that image as I go along, I think it will be a little bit easier for some of you to follow. We hear much talk of a postmodern sensibility today, as if it were opposed to a modern sensibility that we have left behind. This is not quite accurate. A more precise way to put this is to suggest that elements of the modern sensibility are being taken out of context and radicalized into what can reasonably be called a postmodern sensibility, especially regarding philosophical anthropology. Philosophical anthropology is our commitments or beliefs about human nature, or what is also called the human condition. I want to suggest that high modern philosophical anthropology focused its thinking about human nature on the notion of human dignity. We have inherited a notion of human dignity that was created over the course of the 17th and 18th centuries in the midst of great scientific and technological advancement on one hand, and extensive religious wars and violence in both Britain and on the continent on the other. Both phenomena fed into the modern sensibility. Both were born of and directed against the church, more precisely against the clergy, both Catholic and Protestant. The Protestant Reformation gave birth to the powerful vision of the individual who can triumph against the institution and make things different. Theologically, Martin Luther invented the notion of salvation as surety of mind through the tenacity of personal faith, rather than something given through the means of grace and cultivated by love and virtue. The two Protestant notions are not unrelated to the now prevailing notion of human dignity. It is indeed individual surety of mind that strengthens the individual to buck the system, to correct the ills of society. Science and technology picked up and secularized the theological notion of the power of the individual in order to fight magic and superstition, also associated with the church, by the use of the mind, unfettered by philosophy and theology, and armed with the experimental method. In short, the 17th century discovered what writers believed was the power of the clear mind. It became foundational for the modern notion of human dignity. In addition to seeding the notion of the individual, the Reformation also gave way to decades of brutal war, political instability, and religious confusion between opposing religious factions vying for power and control, in which the clergy were implicated and their authority weakened. Further, the rise of modern international commerce created a need for international law that was beyond the scope of ecclesiastical law or existing civil law. In this atmosphere, the creative power of the mind appeared more reliable and more helpful than authoritative institutions. Modern democracy, with its notion of citizenship and rights accruing thereunto, was born out of this mix. Under all of this, a new vision of human nature was forming. The Western Christian teaching was that human beings are creatures created by God in his image and that they fundamentally belong to him. This is the source of their dignity. That is, our dignity is no feature of ourselves, like rationality, but lies in a feature of our identity that we receive passively because we are created in the image of God. St. Augustine also knew how difficult it is to live nobly as a result of this identity, but he believed that growing in the knowledge and love of God would enable us to turn toward our true theological identity. By the end of his life, Augustine came to see that there is a tragic flaw in the human character that suggests that we are morally weak and cannot even see that unless God himself, see that unless God himself shows us that we are weak, we're blind to our own weaknesses. The early Middle Ages added the idea that we are so unable to honor God that we deserve capital punishment, but that God restrains himself from killing us in an act of gratuitous mercy and takes Christ instead. Later, Protestant reformers sharpened this picture to suggest that although we are endowed with the knowledge of God and have access to his will for us, we are utterly morally incapacitated. Through faith in God's mercy that we learn from Christ, we may stave off the punishing wrath of God and our fear of it, but not necessarily be morally healed. Luther. The modern sensibility found this theology degrading and created an alternative. A major achievement of the Enlightenment was the creation of the self. With the emergence of the self, the soul was restricted to the church that was concerned with life beyond the grave, giving the self free rein in this world. As the church became marginal to the culture, the soul became marginal to the self. Since science has still been unable to locate heaven above the earth or hell below it, the fear of divine punishment that ran the old system has largely disappeared, further supporting the loss of the soul and the triumph of the secular self. The Enlightened view asserted that it was time for people to stand up for themselves, as Immanuel Kant put it, in the late 18th century, to be yourself, although he did not mean by that what we now mean by that. And that's the story that this lecture wants to tell. At the end of the 18th century, Kant explained how he thought every mind works so that we can create the moral law and control our desires and obey it. The aspect of the self that I would like to hone in on here is the concept of its dignity, its value or worth. Human dignity, as we generally think of it, is a modern notion, although it has deep Christian roots, as I have suggested. Our modern notion of human dignity combines two distinct elements that are now rarely distinguished from one another. The two elements of human dignity that control much of our thinking in this culture are individuality and autonomy, hence the notion of the autonomous individual. Let us take these one at a time. The self is, above all, individuated. It is the result of the narration of a specific and unrepeatable life. This idea was put forward by John Locke. Every life is different. Discoveries like the individuality of fingerprints, handwriting, and genetic inheritance, although the degree of variation in these in all cases is quite narrow, reinforce the idea of the irreducible uniqueness of the individual. Further, we accept that circumstances also feed into the formation of the individual. The choices we make in our lives, some bare facts about our makeup, and the events and situations that shape our personalities and interests calculate our individuality. Yet it is a big jump from recognizing the fact of individuality to the message, or really the flat-out lie and terrible theology, that Sesame Street taught to millions of children, singing, "You're the most important person in the whole wide world." How many of you were raised hearing that? "The most important person in the whole wide world, it's you, and you hardly even know you." Raise your hands. Now, we are getting ahead of ourselves here. My point is that individuality is an empirically demonstrable aspect of the human person. Whether this is an indisputably good thing, as Sesame Street has promoted, as the slogan "Celebrate Diversity" suggests, is another matter. The other aspect of the modern notion of human dignity is, I've suggested, autonomy. Autonomy means self-governing. It was first applied to nation states in the early 17th century to indicate their legal independence from one another. It is also used in physiology of those aspects of the body that are independent of conscious control, like the beating of the heart and the autonomic nervous system. My dictionary does not have an entry for autonomy as a philosophical term relating to human nature. This was a move made by Immanuel Kant, who used it to suggest that our dignity resides in the capacity of the human mind to be morally self-governing. Three philosophers, Crucius, Rousseau, and Kant, created the notion that we do not need moral guidance. While philosophical autonomy at first seems opposed to the Christian view that we are morally dependent upon God, it actually relies on a Christian notion, quite clear in John Calvin, that despite human fallenness, we retain within us the seed of religion. That is what we now call conscience, the ability to distinguish right from wrong. That we are created in the divine image has often been interpreted to mean the human capacity to reason. And that is the Christian source of the modern idea of autonomy, meaning morally self-governing. It is not surprising that the modern notion of human dignity thus rests on an important Christian doctrine taken out of context and radically secularized. According to Christian theology, this natural knowledge of good and evil is disabled by our self-centeredness, which only God can handle. At the same time, God created us as rational creatures. It makes sense to say that if we know the difference between good and evil, we can use our reason to suppress the propensity toward evil in ourselves and to enhance the good. Christianity inherited these ideas from the ancient Greeks, especially Plato, who was not an atheist, by the way. At any rate, once these ideas escaped a Christian theological context, sin began to be seen as a demoralizing concept, useful more to keep the clergy in power and maintain social order than heal the soul. The beautiful power of the mind was thought to be able to direct the will toward the good. This is the core of the notion of human dignity as residing in the capacity for moral self-governance. We do not need help from God in moral matters because we can identify the good and conform our behavior to it by making good decisions. We have what we need to govern ourselves well, our mind. In fact, in order to be true to ourselves, that is to live into our dignity, we must exercise our capacity for self-governance, our moral freedom. On the battlefield, soldiers should disobey immoral orders from their superiors, for example. This notion suggests that the value and worth of an individual, his or her inherent dignity, lie in the inherent ability of the mind to know the good and be able to impose strictures on one's desires in order to do it. So the soldier should risk court-martial rather than kill innocent civilians. To review, now the notion of individuality is an empirical notion, open to observation and scientific verification. That's my first point about individuality. Second, the capacity for moral self-governance, extracted from a political context dealing with nation states, is a bit harder to get at. It is an assertion about our mental capacities based on the assumption that all normal minds are alike and work the same way. When Kant invented the notion of autonomy at the end of the 18th century, he did not attach it to to individuality. Although the concept of individuality had begun to take shape with John Locke in the previous century. On the contrary, Kant, on the continent, believed that barring illness and deformity, all minds are equally and similarly endowed, so that in using them properly, we would all arrive at the universal moral law that everyone was capable of understanding and obligated to obey. This is the foundation of a civil society. And a moral society, and a cohesive social fabric. This notion is about this view of the mind is the source of what he called pure reason, the idea that the mind can, so to speak, stand apart from or remain unaffected by the world in which the culture in which it lives, and operate only according to its own natural capacities, which impose meaning on phenomena that come through the senses. Indeed, the universal moral law was foundational to Kant's moral concern to identify the epistemological foundation for a socially cohesive society once miracles and revelation became problematic and untrustworthy. As traditional authority deteriorated, the mind was turned to as an alternative source of cohesive society. Autonomy, as descriptive of human nature, in our case, is far removed from Kant's use of the term. We often use it simply as a placeholder for human freedom, to think and act as one sees fit. It has become a right rather than an assertion about the nature of the mind. Rather than indicating the capacity for unified moral self-governance based on the assumption that all minds will arrive at the same conclusion in moral matters, autonomy now in our day has come to be seen as a right, entitling each person to be treated in certain ways in accordance with their dignity. It is now coupled, autonomy has now been coupled with individuality, which is seen as a description of our personalities rather than the sum of the narration of our life. That is, the idea that we have the ability to think clearly has been linked with the fact of individuality or individual personality and a belief in the supreme value of personal freedom to yield the confused and dangerous idea of individual autonomy. We are responsible on this view only to the uniqueness of our own personality, and everyone must honor and respect it. This incoherent notion is now taken to be the core of our value, that is, our dignity. Once these two incomparable terms, individuality and autonomy, came to be related and even merge into one another, we get a vastly different notion of human dignity than any of its progenitors envisioned. Here I will argue two points. One is that the synonymity of autonomy and individuality is based on a logical confusion. The other is that even if autonomy were a verifiable principle, the autonomy principle is deeply flawed as a principle of self-governance. It is a bad choice as a principle for human dignity because the mind is, that's your mind and my mind, is far weaker than the moderns, especially Kant, thought. Autonomy itself reflects a flawed view of the nature of the mind and its formation. First, the equation of autonomy with individuality is false because it is based on a logical error. It mistakes the assertion of autonomy for an empirical fact. An assertion about human nature is not a fact about human nature, which a fact of our human nature is our individuality. Beliefs and observable facts are different categories of thing. What would it mean, for example, to think that the observation that cow dung makes good fertilizer is because cows are sacred animals. Wait, we want to say, the idea of the sacredness of cows has nothing to do with the fact that dung is good fertilizer. One is a religious notion or an assertion about the nature of cows that cannot be proved or disproved, but whose authority resides in our endorsement of it. The other, that cow dung is good fertilizer, is a scientific claim that withstands empirical scrutiny. It is the case, whether we believe it or not, that dung is good fertilizer. But what if the belief in the sacredness of cows is not understood to be a belief, but is mistaken for an empirical fact, so that the two claims seem to correlate, even imply one another? In this case, we might collect cow dung and keep it in our houses as a blessing, or criminalize beef eating as a threat to human survival because it denies us the use of cow dung. Or let's take an example a little bit closer to home. Suppose we believe or assert that women are morally superior to men and recognize the empirical fact that only women bear children. If their superiority is mistaken as empirically demonstrable rather than being a moral assertion, we might conclude that only women are competent to govern nations because only they bear children and are so better able to shape the future because they have a natural investment in the future. While we can see that this conclusion does not follow from the premise, I think we can also see that a culture that believes in the moral superiority of women might be captivated by such a false argument. Now, to return to our case, we have invented the non sequitur of the autonomous individual because we have forgotten that autonomy is a belief or an assertion about human life. We take it to be a demonstrable fact. But this is not so. A case can perhaps more easily be made that human beings are morally unself-governable. That is why we need laws. Perhaps this is easier to grasp if we recall the original political context of autonomy, the idea of self-governance of nation-states. Modern history is filled with examples of states that move from being part of empire to being self-governing. We readily see that both options are possible. It may now be harder to see that with regard to persons, because the idea of being governed by God rather than by self has become a preposterous and dangerous thought in public discourse. Still, if we are to understand the incoherence of the notion of the autonomous individual, and consequently the reality of our situation, we must strain to think outside of contemporary presuppositions. The confusion between an assertion and a fact is not surprising. Words and ideas cannot be kept in tow once they appear in print. Clearing up the confusion about our understanding of human dignity is a continuing project that I'm trying to undertake, but here I will offer some preliminary comments. We have forgotten that Kant's doctrine of human autonomy is an assertion about or belief in the rational purity of the human mind, that all minds think alike in moral matters, that he tested through the application of the categorical imperative. Forgetting this limited understanding, autonomy is taken to follow from the observation of individuality. In this view, persons are theoretically unable to work together and each one's preferences and judgments are to be held inviolable. Instead of being a feature of the human mind that unifies all persons and provides moral harmony in society as Kant predicted or intended, autonomy, now connected to individuality, has modulated into an idea that inherently separates people from one another. Now autonomy is thought to be tied up with uniqueness because it has been reshaped by the concept of individuality. When human dignity becomes the notion that we are morally self-guided, It is treated as an aspect of our individual uniqueness or personality. The individual is no longer connected to other people, but isolated from them. Concern for them must come from graciousness of heart. For no one has inherent connection to other people. That's why you're always being harangued to be generous and gracious from the pulpit, because it's assumed that you don't see a connection to other people naturally, because you're so individual and unique. Moral knowledge becomes an expression of personality, not the truth that all more normal minds arrive at knowledge that yields, that moral knowledge that unifies society, as Kant taught. Belief in autonomy, as if it were inherent, as if it were an inherent right to be different, rather than a belief about the common nature of the mind, wedded to the fact of individuality, quite undermines the need for, as well as the possibility of social order. Autonomy then functions in direct opposition to the intention of its inventors. It leads to anarchy rather than social cohesion once personal preferences become authoritative and there is no authority external to the self. With personal uniqueness raised to the level of a criterion of personhood, the self easily becomes a monster, devoid of all ties to that which is not self. Belief that our dignity depends on how others treat us in our differentness suggests that no external framework of law or morality can encompass all persons without trespassing on their dignity, for law itself must restrain differences. This would not be the case if autonomy and individuality were carefully understood. But when autonomy is assumed to be a fact of life that authorizes the individual to act independently and requires others to respect that independence, we invite trouble. Now we come to Columbine. The teenaged killers at Columbine High School took to their guns in order to disrupt the social order. Why? They did this ostensibly because they were upset with their classmates, angry that they were disrespected by their peers. They donned different dress, enjoyed dissident entertainments, and chose a style that marginalized them from most of their classmates. One argument put forward as to why they did this is that they were ostracized for their differentness. They were understandably hurt by the harshness that teens display toward one another with unkind comments, glances, backbiting, and social exclusion. You all experienced it in high school yourselves. They murdered, in short, because they interpreted the response to their idiosyncratic behavior as an illegitimate offense against their dignity, their worth or value in their colleagues' eyes, classmates' eyes. They failed to receive the respect to which they believe they were entitled by right of their dignity. It is precisely their classmates' failure to honor their individuality that led them to ridicule and ostracize these boys. Finally, in a great expression of their autonomy, the boys invented their own version of justice in order to retaliate against their disrespectful classmates. In short, this argument runs, the victims brought this on themselves by failing to obey the law of respect for diversity necessary to honor the cult of individuality. The boys' sense of freedom, of their own worth and freedom, on the other hand, entitled them to even the score. These boys were being individuals and were not honored for it. And so there is an excuse offered. This analysis attempts to excuse the evil committed on the grounds of both autonomy and individuality. We heard a lot of this in the papers at the time from psychologists and so on. And all of psychology is now deeply embedded in the ideology of the autonomous individual. It accepts the idea that social order in the school broke down because children will be cruel to one another. In response to the disrespect to their individuality, the boys made their own moral rules to right the wrong on the assumption that they're morally autonomous. The killer boys were carrying out a vendetta against their dignity because their dignity was offended. In some distorted terms, the boys believed that their actions were justified, even if they knew that they did was against the law. The personal overpowered the rule of law and decency, perhaps because they so prized their autonomy and freedom that their responsibility to themselves gave their own integrity priority over everything else. We have, I believe, taught this to these children, all the children, that their dignity is the highest principle, trumping even the lives of others. I believe that in many cases, the church's youth programming also teaches this. Even if they were not capable of, even if it's not explicit, it's implicit in the whole understanding of adolescence and the purpose of adolescence. Even if they were not capable of such moral reflection, because their brains were not yet mature enough, they were not fully developed, the rule of law and social conventions were not internalized in the boys enough to overpower their hurt and anger. Let us come to the result. If the boys thought that they were acting to protect their dignity, they failed miserably. What they did was besmirch it. They denied their true freedom and dignity by showing themselves as slaves of their anger and hurt. The boys were deeply confused, but their confusion is neither idiosyncratic nor abnormal. We all suffer it. I'm going to skip a little section here so that we can allow some time for questions. At this point, I will try to draw what I think is an important implication from the analysis of the Columbine situation that I just offered. I think we are operating out of a false and potentially dangerous doctrine of human dignity that has theological dimensions and calls for a theological response. Many factors combine to create the Columbine killers. Among the concerns, I want to suggest two. One, the boys had a distorted theology. They saw their, everybody has a theology, right? Everybody has a theology. They may not be aware that they do. They may not be aware of what it is, but everybody operates out of a theology. These boys saw their dignity as dependent upon how they were treated by others. This is at the core of the self-esteem movement, which was developed to help inner-city children, which turned out to be a complete failure. The idea that the more highly we think of ourselves, the better and more productive we will be. Now, it turned out that it didn't work with inner-city children because they didn't have low self-esteem to start with. So increasing their self-esteem didn't help them become more productive. The boys had a theology that placed themselves at the center of things, and they had no alternative source of dignity or succor if others did not meet their expectations. It is a case of self-esteem gone berserk. Second, they did not connect their dignity with their own pattern of life, responsibilities, and behavior. That is, they saw their dignity as an entitlement rather than as something that arises from living in a certain way. This is to suggest that where they were not trained to know well, but were badly culturally misshapen. I call this, using the Greek word dyspeidousia, it means culturally malformed or maleducated. They were victims of the myth of the autonomous individual. The autonomous individual I've been suggesting is a dangerous contradiction in terms. That we are individuals is true. That we are autonomous is much less clear. I have already argued that from a psychological, genetic, and social perspective, It is not the case that we are autonomous. From a Christian point of view, autonomy was never even considered. Once we separate autonomy from individuality, we can see that the impossibility of autonomy on Christian grounds does not impugn our individuality or our freedom. In fact, the modern recognition of individuality is, I believe, a great help and assistance to Christian theology, because I think, for example, it helps us understand sin more broadly and more subtly than we would before. But this is not the place to digress into that. Here I am more interested in pointing to the errors in the notion of autonomy, both on the modern terms in which Kant invented it and in its subsequent distortions, in order to retrieve a notion of human dignity that is safer than the one we currently have. I believe, this is a little parenthesis, I believe that neurophysiology will be a great help to us here, but unfortunately I have not explored it yet deeply to know yet enough to know exactly how. I do think, however, that it is not unreasonable to expect that the genetic discovery that we differ from one another only within a very narrow range might well prove to be as true in brain research as it turns out to be in genetics, handwriting, and fingerprints. That is, while it may be true that all normal brains, in all normal brains, various areas of the brain control the same functions and work in more or less the same patterns, it may also be the case that there is enough individual variation within the brains of different individuals to suggest that Kant's assumption of the universalizability of moral deliberation is simply not workable. We're past Kant. Until we have support from neuroscience, however, I will argue that autonomy is a false concept, even apart from its Christian challenge that we are creatures of God and therefore morally dependent. I suggest that cultural conditioning shapes the patterns and possibilities of thought that we exhibit or fail to exhibit far more than Kant imagined. At the same time, I suspect that our mental and especially our moral functioning in that, we are all far more alike than the social constructionists, on the other hand, would have us believe. Be that as it may, my point here is that we are not autonomous and able to act rationally on the sense data that come to us, as Kant taught. Rather, the very way our minds work is shaped by the interactions we have with others, the ideas we are exposed to, the expectations we are led to have by television, entertainment, so on. This is to say that our mental capacities are not autonomous, but to a large extent, the result of our interaction with the world. If this is true, it means, first of all, that we are not capable of the pure reasoning in which Kant and modernity placed so much hope. Second, it means that to some extent, our minds are not under our control, so that suggesting that we use them to control untoward emotions can never be fully effective. That is, even when they function within normal limits, our minds are somewhat weaker and more unstable than modernity hoped. Although this does not get us to the heart of the matter, it does move us a step further away from the Columbine killers because it points out the sociality of the mind. That is, even in the putative privacy of our own heads, others are present. There is no pure mind or thought. The loss of the notion of pure thought, sad as it is for the cult of autonomy, did have some bright spots. It reinforced the truth of individuality, but in a different context. It recognized individual variation, not in isolation, but in the midst of community. If our minds are mostly the same, yet each different, like our fingerprints, so that we are individuals, our differentness is not like that of our fingerprints and handwriting. They are incorrigible, unalterable. You can't change your fingerprints except by burning your hand. Our mental differences from one another may be genetic, but some of this is also socially or culturally influenced. That is, our capacity for thinking, on which we live our lives and pin our hopes, is not really our own affair, but due to the fact that we are embedded in a community that is linked together in a framework of interpretive meaning that we convey to one another and help one another use in various ways. In short, even the most introverted among us is never alone. We all dwell together in one another's heads. Perhaps this will become clearer by discussing Michael Oakeshott's 1925 essay on the nature and meaning of sociality. Oakeshott believed that British society was then suffering from a failure to understand the true nature of human sociality. Most of the essay criticizes the reigning notions either taken from sociology, economics, biology, or utilitarianism. All of these, he argues, confuse sociableness, gregariousness, for example, with sociality. The former makes contractual relations possible, but the latter, sociality, makes excellent selves. The possibility of excellent selves requires the union of minds in friendship, so that love and sharing deeply in other people's minds become part of the self. Society, he holds, is a spiritual whole. Christians designate it as love. Oakeshott stresses the unity and life of life and mind, which we call love and friendship. Yet he goes further and locates the possibility of sociality in religion. This is Oakeshott. God is the only principle of sociability which will explain the facts of life. Society becomes possible by religion. In an explanatory note, he adds, I should always come back to the good as the only principle of sociality. And for Christians, the good, of course, is God. Perhaps it looks like Oakeshott considered that unity of mind with the company we choose to keep would be upbuilding and spiritually beneficial. He mentions books and solitude as ways of cultivating the excellent social self. The naivete of this position, of this suggestion, speaks to our condition. The minds of the Columbine killers were taken over by other minds, loyalties, and friendships, but not good ones. The minds of Harris and Klebold were colonized, but by the wrong world. They were united to evil rather than to good, and it destroyed them, and I'm going to venture to say it is destroying us as a nation. That is, there is, on the opposite view from the autonomous individual, a transpersonal framework within which we live and move and have our being. We are not ever alone. All our desires and decisions are part of a larger whole, and they in turn affect the whole, even if we cannot see it at the time. I had two examples here, but I'm kind of running out of time. You'll probably be able to fill in your own examples. We think, for example, I guess the basic one is we think that our sexual behavior is our own, is our private affair. It is nothing of the sort. All of our sexual behavior is very public because it has extremely public consequences that the whole society must deal with all the time. The point is that autonomy and privacy, which has become its corollary, completely opposite to anything that Kant had in mind, these notions are self-deceptions, especially, as I say, about sex, where we want it most. To the extent that we associate our dignity with our freedom and privacy to pursue our pursuits, we are avoiding the truth about ourselves. The truth is, rather, that we live in webs of inter-effectiveness. What happens to us and what we do affects others, whether we are immediately aware of it or not. A more realistic understanding of our dignity has to do with how we deal with the fact of that our individuality at times brings us into tension with the web of inner effectiveness of which we are a part. how skilled we are at negotiating those tensions and protecting others from the effects of our individuality has a lot to say about our dignity. Harris and Klebold misunderstood their own dignity at precisely this point. Their notion of their own dignity failed to work for them in a difficult situation. I've now perhaps made my point that theology is unavoidable, and good theology is absolutely necessary. It is unavoidable because the webs of inter-effectiveness within which we move and have our being while inside us is also outside us. It is beyond us in that we did not create it. Even though we contribute to this web, and it donates itself back to us. It has a life of its own. I have some more examples here, but I would say, for example, following on this same line, for example, the demise of marriage in our society now, I think, is another example. People are avoiding marriage in various ways because they feel that the alternatives are more personally satisfying to them. My question is, if we think about the web of inter-effectiveness, what does the loss of marriage mean for the culture as a whole in terms of relating our personal interests to the society, that is, I should say, to the common good? The truth is that we are all part of something greater than our own immediate self-interest. Anselm of Canterbury recognized this at the turn of the first millennium in his Cur Deus Homo when he says that the power of sin is that it creates a semblance of disorder in the scheme of things. To say that there is a scheme of things means that reality is ordered and meaningful, and our bodies and souls are part of that order. Misusing them or undertaking projects that disturb that order are sometimes undertaken to improve our circumstances within it, but sometimes damage it. The web of inter-effectiveness places responsibilities on us, and our dignity is enhanced or diminished in relation to how well or how poorly we handle these responsibilities. It calls us to recognize the true power that we exert in acting so as to strengthen or weaken the social fabric. The web is transcendent, beyond us, yet we shape it. It is real and we name it, yet no instance or object that we can point to captures it. It is always there, yet constantly changing. When we strengthen the web of inter-effectiveness, we enhance our dignity. When we damage it, we diminish our dignity and that of others. Now let me conclude. I have suggested that the notion of the autonomous individual is incoherent and dangerous. We misunderstand ourselves if we think we are autonomous individuals. Rather, we are individuals embedded in a transcendent web of inter-effectiveness that both creates who we are and provides opportunities for us to express our individuality. To think that our dignity lies in some intrinsic value of the self to which others owe honor is to fail to grasp that our dignity depends upon our own behavior as we interact with others and the world within which we live. Now, the theological implications of this are extremely significant because my argument, and I'm sorry, I don't have, I didn't think this would take quite so long. The theological dimension of this is that from a Christian point of view, our identity and our what governs us ultimately comes from God. And for those who are baptized into the death of Christ and participate in the body of Christ, have no on them autonomy has no claim. Because by virtue of being baptized, we are part of a transpersonal, cosmic reality that binds us to one another. And so what I suggest in sum is that the church, in baptizing members of this autonomous culture into itself is the best alternative to the dangers of the autonomous individual. Thank you.